This is Indie Book Publishing. Indie Book Publishing is a show about new books and the authors who wrote them. It's an opportunity for prospective readers to hear directly from the writers, to hear what inspired them to write and publish, and to hear all the inside details about their books. And now, Indie Book Publishing.
For Indie Book Publishing, Archway Press, this is J. Douglas Barker. The book is titled, We Must Change the Way We Live, an introspective view of the value of education and financial prudence in a changing world. And joining me from, near Chicago, Dr. Pat Obey, who is the author, and he's joining me by phone today. Welcome, sir, to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. We visited just a little bit before our recording started, and understand you have some history with Nigeria and also with my home country of Canada. Share with my listeners a little of your early childhood and how you ended up in Chicago.
Well, I grew up in the early 60s in Nigeria, so I was a child that was a victim of the Nigerian Civil War between 1966 and 1970, and so it was that kind of provided me with a little bit of a talking point in the first chapter of the book, but I also refer to my dad's education in Canada in a university that used to be called Waterloo Lutheran University. The current name though is Wilfrid Laurier University in Kitchener, Canada, so that was an opportunity for him to upgrade himself, educationally speaking, which served us quite well in the years after the Nigerian Civil War. So the interregnum between 1966 and 1967 was a time of extreme hardship, and that I discussed quite extensively in the first chapter of the book.
You have 128 pages. You are a finance major or finance specialist, or that's where you focus your time. Share with my listeners a little about what you do as an educator. What is your focus there, and why did you focus on planning and finances in your book?
Well, my PhD from the University of Mississippi is in finance and econometrics. Econometrics is a field of applied statistics. And so when I began my life permanently in the United States in the early 80s at Texas State University, starting off with an MBA, my intention was to go into a field of business with some technicality to it. And the choice was going to be either accounting or finance. And then a little bit as to how I decided on finance is also something I talk about in the first chapter of the book. But anyhow, I felt that is a field that would actualize my ambitions of growing up into a commanding leadership position in academia. So from there, from Texas State, I then moved on to the University of Mississippi, where I eventually earned my PhD. And from then on, I became a professor of finance here at Purdue University, and I'm in the Calumet campus, which is right outside of the city of Chicago, Illinois. We're in the southeast side in a small city called Hammond, Indiana.
I'm familiar with
it. So pursuant to that, I have had the privilege of consultant for both the U.S. government, the State Department specifically, as well as various companies, and also some country and local governments around the world. I believe on the last count, I've done about 52 countries. Wow. And so the culmination of my international professional experiences, and motivated by what happened in 2007-2008 financial crisis, is what sets the stage for the book, We Must Change the Way We Live.
Are you focusing on younger people coming up that need to save for education, or is there a broader appeal to your book than that?
There is a broader appeal to the book, most definitely. Well, first off, the book is not a textbook. It's a book on financial education, and is targeting a general audience. It's specifically parents and young people. And so it's one that's easily understood by anyone with at least a high school level education, and it's designed to inform and teach. For parents, it serves as a guide to plan wisely on matters concerning household spending, children's future, education, life insurance, personal investments, and stuff like that. And for young people, it does provide them with a compass on how to make choices regarding which college major to choose, or, for that matter, which professional training to pursue if they choose not to go to college. And more importantly, how to finance that education in a way that will positively impact their life going forward after graduation. And as I mentioned quite extensively in the book, what lies after graduation are going to be some of the most daunting life decisions, such as settling into a career, deciding on marriage and family, mm-hmm. buying or renting a property, going for consumer credits, you know, credit cards, saving for retirement, of course. So these are the many aspects of personal financial aspects that are embedded in the second part of the book, which, if I forgot to mention, that little book is in three parts. The first part deals with education, second part with personal finance, and the final part deals with, quite so boldly, national finance.
Mm. That's a tough one to take on.
Tough one to take on. And what I tried to do was to kind of create a consciousness as to how it is that poor decisions and choices at the government level also contributed to the intensity of that financial crisis. And I do that in a way that it's, I think if you haven't read the book, you would see it's in a conversational manner so that the average individual can understand. And that way, when people watch certain news on television, it doesn't quite, getting this basic understanding doesn't quite come across so technical that oftentimes when people become apathetic to what goes on in the economy, we find ourselves unwittingly being victims of the things that go wrong, as happened during the mortgage crisis in 2007.
You have included in your book many, many charts and comparisons of those who have an education, don't have an education, depending on socioeconomic conditions and also on ethnicity. You have done a well-researched book. What was the most difficult part of putting this book together?
A very good question. I think the most difficult part is finding a solution to a problem. Finance is financial management deals with solutions. And so when I look at the state of public education in America and find how far behind we lag to many other countries, and I'm sure you're familiar with how poorly we rank when it comes to science and mathematics.
Yes.
So from a financial standpoint, we are problem solvers, and looking at the situation in our inner cities where our public education system is at its worst, the question is, what can we do to remedy this ailing, very, very ailing problem? And from my standpoint, and I pull no punches, my mother is a retired school teacher. I'm a teacher by profession, even though at the university level. But at the end of the day, the role of the teacher is to change a life, to be the master and the architect of the life of a young person. And my focus on the chapter dealing with education is to stay focused on the child. What can be done to ensure that at the end of the process, the child is successful? And success in the book is in terms of what you can do to help society, what contributions you can make to society. So the difficulty in that is coming up with what I term military-style academies. And hey, it's not a military school as such, but it is a learning environment that's structured, that's discipline-focused, mm-hmm. and I give examples of that. And I also point to the fact that I am a product of such an institution of learning, and it does have huge benefits, especially where you come from a home that has deficiencies in that maybe neither of the parents is educated well enough, or maybe you live in a neighborhood where crime is high, or maybe you simply are a bad child, regardless of the best efforts and intentions of your parents. So these structured learning environments provide children with the opportunity to make tough choices that in the end to grow up as successful members of society.
Do you address anything like charter schools or those paths to education in your book, or is that something that you have not considered here?
I did, but not in the traditional sense. I instead point to specialized educational institutions such as the one set up by Jeffrey Canada in the city of New York. It's called Harlem Children's Zone.
Yes.
I point to the fact that such learning environments can be put together because the success of Harlem Children's Zone is far greater than the success of many of these charter schools.
Wonderful. You have tackled a difficult subject. A lot of parents, I'm one of them, that consider just get an education. Doesn't matter what the degree is in. It's not that critical. That has changed, I think, over the last maybe 8 to 10 years. It's really important that a student find their love, their focus, and their passion when they approach education. How do you feel about that, and how do they become focused on something that will benefit them long range?
That's another excellent question right there, because one of the things that I deal quite clearly in the part that deals with education is that a good education has to have three goals. One is it's got to lead into a career or a job that puts food on the table, because you have to feed yourself and feed family. So
right.
That very basic human need has to be satisfied. Secondly, it has to be a career that empowers you and makes you proud and happy to practice it. It's very important, because that attribute of our existence is as fundamental as eating food. You know, the ability to wake up in the morning with a smile on your face. And thirdly, you must have, it has to be education that leads to, that gives you the capacity, you have the capacity or the ability to do well in the field of study that will lead you to that career. So if, for example, you want to be an astronaut, well, you better be willing to work hard and learn physics and mathematics, for example. You wouldn't want to be something that you have decided you're unwilling to learn the skills that will lead you into it. So based on that, I caution that in the end, it's not how much money you make that is of the essence.
Good.
It has to be whether you are in a career that gives you that total fulfillment. You can make $30,000 a year and be far greater fulfilled than someone who makes $300,000 a year. So keeping these three attributes in view, I think it's helpful overall.
Are you finding also that there are new support, safety nets in place for those who are like me? I don't like to reflect much on my education, other than I was a square peg in a round hole. And there are those that respond to education and respond to learning in different methods than what was effective maybe 25 or 30 years ago. What are you finding?
That is excellent, because part of the success of these structured learning environments is to focus on the specific skill sets of the child.
Beautiful.
And on the variations in the abilities of children. No two children are the same in every way when it comes to learning. You know, some are going to be quicker to pick up the answer to 2 plus 2. Some are going to be quicker to picking up, to demonstrating strong cognitive skills, for example. So it's not, and I know I'm making a broad statement. However, when you have a structured and discipline-focused environment, then you have to have teachers that have the abilities to identify any types of specific learning needs that children have in those learning environments and focus on them. And again, my personal experiences going through such a boarding school environment are the things that I share. And I believe that the empowerment that I teach in the book is what I believe that can help parents in particular to learn how to manage their children growing up, especially when they're in grammar schools.
Dr. Obi, in recapping your book, how would you describe it, and what is your ultimate wish for those who read it?
Well, the book, We Must Change the Way We Live, should be viewed not simply as a book that informs, but one that teaches and empowers. The goal is to learn the tools that can help us enjoy a standard of living that is both fulfilling and valuable, and not only to ourselves, but also, and perhaps more importantly, as I explain in the book, to society. I believe that it is in so doing that we have a greater sense of accomplishment and satisfaction, and that's the ethos, my personal ethos in my own American journey as a citizen of a country where by reaching out to your neighbor, you find fulfillment in being an American. And that can only happen if we demonstrate prudence in how we manage our resources, of which money is a key part.
Beautifully stated. Wonderful. Thank you for sharing your story and sharing the background into this book. The title again is We Must Change the Way We Live, an introspective view of the value of education and financial prudence in a changing world. My guest has been Dr. Pat Obi, O-B-I. If you're doing a search online, Dr. Obi, where can they get a copy of your book? And do you have something else in the future in the works?
Well, first off, they can get the book quite so easily by going to my website, which is patobi.com. Pat Obi is my name's put together. P-A-T is Pat, O-B-I, B as in boy. So patobi.com. And so in there, they'll see a bunch of video clips and radio interviews, which also would include this clip, where they can learn a lot more about the contents of the book. And what I'm currently working on has to deal with, it's an extension of the book that deals with international tourism and how, how countries can take advantage of the fact that tourism industry is the largest growth industry right now in this global environment that we live in. So it's not a book on personal finance. It is a book on national finance.
Fascinating. 128 pages of this book, We Must Change the Way We Live. Thank you, sir, for joining me today and sharing your story.
Thank you so much for having me again.
My pleasure. For Indie Book Publishing Archway Press, this is J. Douglas Barker.
Listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages. Congratulations on being the proud owner of an adorable, soft, cuddly, sweet-smelling, smiling, cooing, hungry, tired, gassy, screaming little bundle of joy. So now what? Where's the owner's manual for this thing? Where are my instructions? Right here. It's Baby and Toddler Instructions with Blythe Lipman on TogiNet.com. Infant care specialist Blythe Lipman has worked with babies for over 20 years and works extensively with new parents, providing workshops, in-home visits, tips, and daily phone calls to ease those frazzled nerves. With Baby and Toddler Instructions, you can get the advice you need on how to survive and enjoy your baby's first year. For more information on Blythe and how she can help you, go to babyinstructions.com. From 32 ways to stop a baby from crying to 14 ways to get a baby to eat and so much more, it's Baby and Toddler Instructions with Blythe Lipman on TogiNet.com. Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world.
Greetings for Indie Book Publishing, Abbott Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. The book today is titled Seeds of Destruction. And joining me from near Boston, Massachusetts, is author Dr. Gary Miller Prue. Thank you, sir, for joining me today.
Oh, you're welcome. It's a pleasure.
This is your first novel. How would you describe this novel? Would you describe it as an adventure? Would you describe it as a mystery? What is the general category?
Well, I would say the general category would be a medical thriller, but it is really kind of, I would say, a hybrid where it's a medical-terrorist thriller, also mystery, all sort of combined to some extent.
You are a medical doctor. Your character in this book, there are some similarities to your profession, if I am reading this correctly.
Yes, that's true. I'm an oncologist, and so is Dr. Miller, the protagonist. And that has actually a lot of interest to me, obviously, but expertise I feel that has that allowed me to develop this character in a realistic, detailed way.
Did you incorporate, and I'm guessing this would be a question, but did you incorporate some of the experiences you've had as a doctor into the fabric of your novel?
Yes, to some extent I did, as I said, because I think that the expertise I had with that lended itself to my being able to develop the character and the scenes in a realistic way, and that would include the opening where the Dr. Miller is doing what's called a radiation radioactive seed implant. I've done probably over 1,000 of those. Mm. And also in general, just radioisotopes, the use in medicine, particularly oncology, I have a wealth of experience with.
What about the story itself, the mystery, the intrigue, any of that something that you have experienced or have viewed from your perspective as a doctor, a physician?
Yes, in the sense that in addition to, as I said, my experience with using radiation in medical treatment, in particular cancer patients, I do have connections through both my experience being a physician in the military, as well as friends who are physicians in the military who have been involved with terrorist activities and the use of radiation, and have incorporated the threat of that to develop this story. And therefore, although it is fiction, it has some realistic qualities to it. We all hope this never becomes a reality, but as I point out, it is not just a matter of if, but when, according to experts in terrorism, where radiation can be used for terrorist activities. So,
would you also, I guess, indirectly call this a book of warning or caution, a cautionary tale?
Perhaps, yes. I guess I would venture to go so far as to say something like that. I certainly, it wasn't my main motive to make this a preaching of this, but I felt it was a compelling story to tell. And I told it in a fictional way because at this point it remains that way, and I hope it remains fictional. But at the same time, it is, for those who do have interest in realism, it is something that is quite possible in the wrong hands.
You have been a physician for a number of years. What was the motivation to become an author as well, especially in the fictional genre?
Well, I get asked that a lot because of my busy schedule. People ask, how do I have time, and so forth. And I've actually dabbled in, most of my writing has been in research and scientific realm as both an academic and clinician. But I have always, as a hobby, written mostly on my own, but I've always enjoyed dabbling in writing stories. And I've had a few that have come full. Like, for example, this, obviously we're dealing with terrorism so much, and my connections with physicians who are writers, very famous people, in fact, encouraged me. They read some of my work, and they felt that it was compelling and that they strongly supported and encouraged me to pursue this. So that was probably the number one reason why I went ahead and wrote the book, and it seems to be being well received, so hopefully that'll continue.
Well, congratulations on completing this. How long did it take? Most of my authors have a general time frame that they work within. Was this something that came together quickly, or did it take several years?
I actually, it's an interesting question because of the plot and the setting is the Boston Marathon, but actually I started this 1 year before the Boston bombing because I was down there taking pictures and had a relative running in the race. And so it's been a few years, but I actually had this idea well before the actual bombings took place in Boston. So that's how I know the exact times that I started working on this. And, of course, being a full-time physician, I can't work full-time on it. So it took me a few years to really develop it and make a finished product.
each of the authors I talked to have a different process of developing and fleshing out a storyline. Did you have an outline that you began with, or did you, as many do, begin just with an inspirational concept and begin writing and let it flow from there?
I would say that it was probably of the latter, where I had the concept, the premise, and had in my head a kind of outline, but clearly as I wrote, ideas and changes occurred, and things that I hadn't thought of, characters, settings, and so I would say it was more of the latter. I didn't start with a detailed formal outline.
You have managed to pen over 260 pages of adventure, of mystery, of however you would describe it.
Well, I've been told by others who in the writing field more, they feel it is kind of an interesting, perhaps unique genre where it's a medical. I've heard others coin the term could be coined as a medical terror thriller, mm-hmm. because there are genres for each subtype. But I don't know if that quite fits, but it certainly could fit well with it. It has a lot of mystery too, but I would say overall it probably is using medicine and terrorism in a combined way that, as I said already, I hope this story never becomes true, but it is something that's in the realm of possibility by experts.
Describe for my listeners the scene that to you was the most exciting to pen and one that will grab their attention as they read your book.
I'd say, you know, that's a great question. I love many scenes. Viscerally, they touched me. But I would say that toward the end, toward the climax, where Dr. Miller encounters the antagonist, Zid, where they make a resolution to deter the actual dirty bomb from exploding in a peaceful way, it unfortunately still was set off, but by a different character. But I think one of the points that was hopefully being shown was that we do need to deal with the problems in the world dealing with terrorism and try to do it in a constructive, nonviolent, peaceful way. And that was one point that I thought was very dramatic and compelling.
Did you set the story in the Boston area, the area that you are currently living in?
Yes, it's the main bulk of the story, and certainly dealing with the climax, is, as I mentioned, dealing in Boston with surrounding the Boston Marathon. But as I said, this concept was developed over a year before that actual bombing took place at the marathon in Boston. So that's the concept I had all along, and I stuck with it. I debated whether I should change that setting because of the tragedy that happened, but I felt that this was more of a realistic and certainly something that I was more familiar with, so I decided to stay with it.
As a practicing physician and doctor, is there a long-term goal or something that you wish to achieve as an author besides releasing this novel?
Yes, well, one of the, as I said, I've kind of been a hobbyist writing on my own, call it therapy or whatnot, but I'm hoping, and currently with this book, hoping to use a portion of the proceeds for worthwhile causes and charities such as cancer treatment, as well as, in this particular case, donating a portion of the funds to victims of the Boston bombing that happened a few years ago. And I plan to do that in future books and actually a sequel to this to hopefully develop a foundation where I can use a substantial portion of the proceeds to develop the various causes. So that's a big motivation for me because I not only enjoy the writing and hope others do, but I feel that if I can actually help certain causes that are near and dear to me, that's certainly a big motivation for me to write.
That's an honorable and worthwhile goal and mission. Thank you for doing so. Is there anything that was a challenge that you had to overcome in order to get this completed that perhaps other writers would like to know and avoid?
Well, I guess as has been well penned by many others, writing, you know, it's not something that I think in my talking with many who are writers and reading is something that is always necessarily a fun thing to do. It is work, and it can be lonely. But if you have a story to tell and want to get it out, then you have to pull from within side to do it and overcome certainly a lot of distractions that exist, working and just daily life. But you have to make the time. So I guess that was the one issue I would have, is that you have to make dedicated time if it's something that's inside you and you want to get it out to people.
Do you see this as a possible movie adaptation?
Yes, I do. And in fact, the publisher has been working on developing it into a screenplay to present to their Hollywood contacts, connections, so that that's actually in the works. And that's very, very exciting that to be able to see these characters and scenes come to life and on the screen. That would be truly exciting to see. And I would be honored if that were to happen. But again, you know, I know that that's always a competitive area, so we'll see what happens. Hopefully there'll be enough interest for that.
Oh, love to see that movie when it's produced.
I think it would be very adventurous and action-packed, and if you like those kinds of movies, and a moving type of movie, I think, again, I know they can write it differently than the actual book, but if they follow the book, I think it has the potential to be very moving and entertaining.
The title of the book, again, is Seeds of Destruction. My guest has been Dr. Gary Miller Prue. Sir, where can my listeners get a copy of your book?
Well, the main website would be, there are a variety of usual websites online, such as Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and the publisher, Abbott Press. But I do have a separate website, www.garymillerprue.com, where if the book is bought through that site, I will autograph for each individual who buys it, and the majority of the proceeds that I'm able to keep more will go to those charities that I mentioned. So that's why I encourage people to buy there, but I'm honored if they buy the book at any place. So
phenomenal. And you have a sequel in the works from what you've described.
Yes, I do have a sequel. I'm working on it now, and my goal and my hope is that it will be out for next summer's reading. And so I'm committed to that.
Thank you.
It is actually a trilogy, but got to take it one step at a time. So
phenomenal. Thank you for joining me today. And for my listeners who want to do a search online, Prue is spelled P-R-O-U-L-X. And you can do a search under Gary Miller Prue in order to find out about this book, his writings, and other activities that he'll be involved in the future with a sequel that's soon to be released. Thank you, sir, for joining me today.
Thank you very much. It's been my honor.
For Indie Book Publishing, Abbott Press, this is J. Douglas Barker.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Do you ever wonder if you're the only woman who runs errands in her yoga pants so it will look like she went to the gym? Or how about the only mom who feeds her kids raw cookie dough? Or are you the only one who cooks her family cold cereal for dinner? Do you need more laughter and less loudness? More self-love and less self-loathing? More joy and less judgment? You're not alone. Come to the living room. A place where we get comfy, candid, and confident together. Come seeking sanctuary and leave feeling renewed. We're saving a seat for you. Give yourself some living room today.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world.
Hello, I'm Casey Coomer. The book, Thousand-Year-Old Dream, The One. The author, Rebecca Eyre.
How did you come to write this book? What motivated you? Well, I've been reading romance novels my whole life, and honestly, I'm kind of addicted to them. And I always find that the books that I read, there's always something missing, whether there's not enough action or not enough mystery, not enough adventure or not enough sex. So I, for probably over 20 years, I have wanted to write my own book. But of course, you know, life gets in the way and you never have time. And finally, I thought, you know what? I can't keep waiting. I'll be dead before I ever write a book. So I just sat down and decided to write what I want to read. And I hope that my readers will feel the same way.
Who do you feel this book appeals to and why?
So I think the book will appeal to mostly women of all ages who love romance novels. A novel that has passion and adventure and action, excitement. It's mostly for women, but I think that some men might find it fun to read too, because there's a lot of action in there. And also the book is told from the point of view of women and men, of a woman and a man. So it goes back and forth between the two main characters. So you kind of get the sense what both of them are thinking. So I think mostly women, but men too. But definitely adults, though, because this is a book for adults. It's not for teenagers. It's not for kids.
What's one thing you want readers to take away from your work?
Well, I want them to go on a roller coaster ride with me and never want to get off. And I want them to read this book and want to read more and more and more about these two characters. And I've been telling my friends who have read the books, who read the book, and they have told me that they don't want to rate it by stars. They want to rate it by wet panties. How many wet panties? So instead of 5 stars, they'll give it 5 wet panties. But this is top quality trash, because I read a lot of trash and some of them are pretty bad. Poorly written, stupid storytelling, doesn't make any sense. But this, you get it all. You get quality.
Very nice. What's one scene or characters that you'd like to highlight during this interview?
Well, I have a scene here, but I'm not sure if I can read it on the radio or tell it to you on the radio. It's triple X rated.
Okay. Do you have a version and or maybe just some vague characteristics that you'd like to express?
Yeah, maybe I'll just read the rated PG version instead of the XXX rated version. So this book is about a love story, of course. But unfortunately, without giving a lot away, the two characters cannot be together. And the way that I tell the story, some of it is in dreams. And it's really dreams that they're both having about each other. And that's how they feel, get closer to each other. And there's a lot of supernatural parts of the story. So part of that plays into the supernatural world too. So in this one scene, it's told by the main character Emma's point of view. And she is dreaming, but she's not sure. So she's in a room that's completely white, white walls, white furniture, white bed, and a big square white glass window with the shape of fire in the middle that is red. It must have been twilight because she could barely make out the dark blue sea outside the window. And she's in bed with him. And of course, now it gets into the triple X part. But basically, they're making love in this white room that she doesn't recognize. So a lot of the story has these dream elements in it, but you will see eventually in the next installment of the book that this has meaning, that this is not just a dream, that it actually is foretelling something that will happen in the future.
Before we go any further, where can we find your material?
It's everywhere. So it's on Amazon as a paperback, as a Kindle book. It's on Nook, the Barnes & Noble platform. It's on Lulu.com, which is my publishing company. It's on iBooks. So it's readily downloadable anytime, anywhere for $4.99.
Very nice and very accessible.
Yes.
The author, Rebecca Eyre. The book, Thousand-Year-Old Dream, The One.
How would you introduce your book to a friend or maybe an acquaintance in a few sentences?
Well, I would tell them that my book is a romance novel, first and foremost, but it's not just a romance novel. So it's an erotic romance novel, but it weaves the natural with the supernatural world, and it's not just sex. Sex is number one, but it's got action, it's got adventure, it's got heartbreak, it has a mystery, and of course, love. And it is a fairy tale. So like most romance novels, it is a fairy tale, but incorporating everything for an exciting read.
When and where does this story take place?
The story takes place in present time Croatia. And I chose the setting because there is actually a real thousand-year-old dream. The thousand-year-old dream, the title of the book, it's not made up. It's actually real. So the story is based on real life events. And I really chose this setting because a lot of people don't know. It's happening in our present day, then everybody knows about the story and what happened on the news because you saw it on the news, but you really didn't know the backstory behind it and how important it is for this little country. So that's why I chose it.
That's very interesting. Tell me how your book is unlike others with similar topics. What sets it apart?
So my book is a little different than the other typical romance novels or even the erotic romance novels like 50 Shades of Grey, because most novels concentrate more just on the psychological parts of love and relationships between a man and a woman. So my book takes a little further because I not just read romance novels. I love mysteries. I love spy novels. So I'm trying to incorporate everything into this book. So you're not just going to get your romance. You're also going to get action. You're going to get adventure. You're going to get a lot of supernatural blend in with the natural world. So you're not sure what's what. And I take you through this journey where you find out everything slowly. In the beginning, you know nothing. You think this is just these two people happen to meet by accident in Croatia in the middle of a war. But nothing else you know about them until you slowly find out the changes that happens over time with both of them. So what my book says, it really sets it apart from other romance novels because it takes it a step further. I hope it's what I want to see, and whether I see a movie for entertainment or read a book, is that I want everything at the same time so that it's exciting. It's not boring. One thing I can't stand is boring.
The book, Thousand-Year-Old Dream, The One, by Rebecca Eyre.
What three words do you feel best describe your work?
Exciting, heart-wrenching, because some of it is really sad, and of course, steamy sex.
Steamy, I like that.
Steamy, actually even more than steamy. Supernatural steamy, like beyond your wildest dreams.
Supernaturalistically steamy.
Yes. I was going to make a joke. So for women, they're going to have the wet panties rating. So for a guy, it's going to be how many hard-ons you get.
What was one of the most challenging parts about writing this book?
So the most challenging part about writing it is finding the time to write everything down. I mean, I have so many storylines in my head because this is a trilogy. I got the whole thing planned out already. and have all these storylines and little scenarios of things that are happening, and just trying to have time to put it all down on paper. It's like, I can't write fast enough, and I'll be doing something, you know, taking a shower, and all of a sudden I think of something and I want to write it down, and I don't have enough time. And I'm afraid that if I let some time lapse, you know how you forget and you lose your train of thought, you lose the wording and what you wanted to write. So the most challenging part is having enough time in the day, still go to work and still sleep and still eat and still do all those life things and be able to write a book as fast as I can.
It seems like you're having fun and you're very excited about this. So you have more material in the works.
Oh, I have so much material in the works. Yes, definitely. Oh, I'm having so much fun. I'm getting my own wet panties just writing it. If I wasn't enjoying it, I wouldn't be doing it.
Very well put. Is there anything that we haven't covered you feel your audience needs to know about your work?
Yes, I do want people to know that this writing this book, I mean, even though I have so many storylines and so many things to tell and of where these two characters will go, but it's definitely the most hardest thing I've ever done in my entire life. And so this book was a pure labor of love. I really had to love it, to put this much time and dedication into it. And like I said, I want to write quality trash. I don't want to write crap and just put it out there, just a bunch of words that doesn't make any sense. I really want people to love it and enjoy it. And I hope my readers will enjoy reading as much as I enjoy writing it. And stay tuned for book two and book three.
Well, that's very exciting. Rebecca, thank you very much for being here with us today.
Thank you, Casey, so much for your time.
The book, Thousand-Year-Old Dream, The One. The author, Rebecca Eyre.
You've been listening to Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen. Join us again next week at noon Eastern as Steve interviews another great author.